And welcome back. You're tuned in to the HBCU Nation Radio Show. I'm your host, Anthony Ray. Glad you're joining the broadcast today. And joining us for this segment, we're going to take a moment to listen in to an incredible interview with Dr. Trina Coleman, host of HBCU iRadio's Beyond the Classroom, with Dr. Jalal Hayes, discussing issues relevant to HBCUs and STEM. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to the inaugural edition of Beyond the Classroom. Beyond the Classroom will be discussing things that are STEM-based and also relevant to HBCUs. I'm Dr. Trina Coleman, the host of Beyond the Classroom, and I am very excited to be introducing to you today my guest, Dr. Jalal A. Hayes, the youngest ever doctoral candidate to receive a PhD in the history of Delaware State University. And get this piece, he was 22 years old. I'm like, well, dang, at 22, you know, I was like, yay, I'm graduating, getting a bachelor's degree. But congratulations, Dr. Jalal, and thank you for joining the show with me today.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. I know we're going to have a good time. I'm not even talking about hope. I know we're going to have a good time.
Well, we're going to talk about your accomplishments, of course. We're going to talk about the relevance of STEM. You majored in chemistry, of course, and you know I'm a STEM geek. I majored in physics. And one of the things I want to cover, let me let the guests know, or the listeners know, excuse me, why I named the show Beyond the Classroom. Since this is the first episode, I want to put a little background into it so people are like, well, okay, we want to listen to this every week, because they will.
Yes.
Basically, in the classroom, this is the way I view it, mastery of a selected educational concentration is obtained. So you learn what you learn about whatever you want to learn. For your case, it was chemistry. Mine, it was physics. All of that stuff, for the most part, happens in a classroom or learning environment, such as a laboratory. Outside the classroom is where knowledge is applied to real issues and or problems, and this knowledge is used to confront and solve these issues and problems. So I figured that if we talked about things beyond the classroom, that's where we as alums of HBCU, supporters of HBCU, students, et cetera, can get into real dialogue about what we take away from the HBCU experience with respect to the learning environment. I'm not talking about homecoming and the parties and the sororities. Yeah. We're talking about the real meat of why you're there in the first place.
Exactly.
And focusing on STEM, obviously, one thing, STEM is very forward-facing right now. We have a technocentric landscape in the world, not just the country. And people need to be ready to basically stand up and be ready to fill these jobs or be fluent enough in STEM to have a conversation about it, make sure they're doing the right thing for their kids, and also supporting the HBCUs to make sure they're staying competitive in this environment. So I'm going to let you respond to that.
Well, first off, again, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I definitely agree. If you look at the historical context of historically black colleges and universities, also known as HBCUs, we started off as an educational foundation to serve the needs not just for black or African-American people, for people of color to go have a place where we can get education, but also bring it back and continue that cycle within our communities that are underserved compared to our white or other ethnic counterparts, right? So from my understanding, in response to your question, I believe that, you know, the reason why, if we look at HBCUs now, the climate at the HBCUs are, I wouldn't say suffering, or I would say dealing with a lot of disadvantages, majority of them, is because I think we lost that focus on why do we start up in the first place. But what is our main historical print in the first place? And that is the certain needs of our communities. And if we get back to that, I think we'll be much better. And how does it tie into STEM? Well, not just me being a chemist, I'm also an entrepreneur as well, being the founder of my own company, Elite Universal Network, which our whole concept is making STEAM simple, in addition to being a founder of HBCU STEAM, which is a community where we focus on STEM, science, technology, engineering, as well as concept of arts and mathematics in this HBCU community. I believe that, as you said, we're going more technocentric. That is very important. And in order to be technocentric, we have to get into the fundamentals first, which is the science, the engineering, and, of course, the mathematics, which my mentor coins it as the language of all sciences. So
it is. I agree.
So we have to respect all four letters, not just two letters, which is the technology engineering. That is the beauty of science, technology, engineering, mathematics, but that is not the main part of science, technology, engineering, mathematics.
I agree completely. STEM is many things, and people in general that are not in STEM areas or STEM fields kind of think that it's one word that is all-encompassing, as opposed to dissecting it into the S, T, E, and M of it.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things I wanted to do today, was to educate our listeners about STEM and what it actually means and why it's so important to, A, understand what it actually means, and, B, to help them realize that moving forward in our technocentric environment doesn't mean that learning how to code, for example, is STEM. It's a part of STEM. Or being a maker, or using a makerspace, or building a robot. All of those things are STEM-related, but to get to the point where you are a robot maker as opposed to a robot builder, it requires you to master all of those things, S, T, E, and M, in some sense. At least three out of four.
Yeah.
At least three out of four.
Yeah, and I think that's the misconception of the concept of just having a STEM education. If you look, I did some research on it, and if you think about, I looked at how STEM came about, the historical context of STEM. So STEM came about, the whole acronym of science, technology, engineering, mathematics, came about when Congress put together the STEM Education Act in 2014, or voiced it around July 2014. And the reason why for that act, for that policy, was to pass that people can have a sense of what is technology, in a sense of the coding and the computer science. So if you look at it from a governmental perspective, that's where, I guess, the funding is going towards in regards to the technology and the engineering piece. And that's why a lot of people focus on the engineering and the computer science.
Okay. Now.
In the sense of that. But I still believe, and you probably can agree with me on this, you still need a fundamental concept of the sciences and the mathematics. Because, for example, like I said before, math, or mathematics, is the language of any science. So if you don't understand math, or you can't do math, how are you going to understand scientific principles moving forward, especially in chemistry and physics,
exactly,
which they call it the physical science, so, or the hardcore science.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you going to understand the concepts of those? in addition to that, let's get into technology. Coding is nice, but coding is based off of mathematical principles.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can't, so simply put, if our communities are struggling with fractions, algebra, 1 and 2, calculus, trigonometry, then how are you able to going to be efficiently doing coding?
I agree.
Anyway, now, I know there's a lot of controversy on say, well, you can build apps without coding, that's nice. But in the world that we're stepping into, which is now cybersecurity, those fundamentals are going to be key in order to actually last and sustain in this economy in regards to actually revolutionizing and becoming even more technocentric in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And therefore, that's when you start seeing the cool and the sexy side of what it means to be an actual, quote-unquote, STEM or STEAM profession. Those fundamentals have to be ingrained and in place if you're really going to sustain in this economy in regards to STEAM or STEM.
Exactly. And one of the things I want to interject here is the fact that I know you know, because you've done the dance, you've walked over the coals, so to speak, to get to the PhD.
Yes.
There are things that you had to do and things that I had to do that fall into this bucket, as I call it, of STEMness, to get that degree done. And it was like tying your shoes. It's like, okay, I need to write some script or some code to check to see. I remember doing stuff to make sure my equipment was calibrated when I was working on my my master's degree. I did my master's degree in experimental work. I did my PhD in theoretical work. But doing that experimental work as you did, I know, just looking at the title of your dissertation, and we're going to pull it back a minute because I don't want everybody to be like, what are they talking about? But I know that going back to our topic of STEM, it wasn't just you holding up a test tube all the time like the pictures show. That's the image of a chemist to most people, having a bunch of test tubes and beakers. I know that part of what you had to do was not just chemistry. There's physics involved, just because the word thermodynamics is there.
Yep.
And kinetic, which is movement. And and looking at the doping process, which is chemistry in a way, but is also about energy levels. And there's code to be written. And then you have a storage system, which is engineering.
Yes.
So all of those things are mathematically, you got to know the math in order to get to the thermodynamics and the kinetics and the storage and to be able to calculate the masses and all of those other things that are required to deal with the chemistry and stability of molecules and all of that stuff as it relates to physics and to make sure your storage system is working properly.
Yes.
So understanding STEM from a fundamental level without going up there in the ether where your thing is and mine, and on the, by the way, you have a long title for your dissertation. I think I got you beat for my thesis, but we're going to talk about that offline. Because we're going to STEM out here, people. Sorry. But to break it down, let's start with the fact that we talked about coding and robots. S is science, T is technology, E is engineering, M is mathematics. M is the language. As a matter of fact, I am writing a book about that actual topic.
Okay.
So you need to be able to be fluent in the language. Not just know two or three words. You need to be fluent in mathematics.
Yes,
and it may not sound good to people, but it's the reality of it. And it's about being a scholar. And that's another show I'm going to have you back on, because I think that we're moving away from scholarship and moving too far, too quickly towards workforce. I know people have to work and make money, but you still need to be a scholar.
I totally agree. And it's funny you say that, the language piece is, because that's where my first company, Elite Universal Network, that's what we focus on.
Okay.
Our focus is, in order to get into the STEM culture,
mm-hmm.
or the STEAM culture, whatever you're on now,
mm-hmm.
you have to understand the language. And I think people don't, it's like, for example, I always use this analogy. You go into Spain, or let's
mm-hmm.
say you go into Africa. Let's
mm-hmm.
keep it Africa. So let's say you're going to Africa and you're going to Nigeria, Nigeria. In order to go into Nigeria and actually get the full experience of the culture in Nigeria, you have to know certain parts of the language or the dialect, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think what's happening is, and speaking through my metaphor, a lot of people are jumping into the country or the culture of science, technology, engineering, mathematics, but then when it comes to the language, they run away. They
right.
love the beauty and the facade of how the culture looks.
Mm-hmm.
For example, not nobody, but Black Panther, for example, showed a lot of Afro-tech,
wow.
Hidden Figures, showed the beauty of how women is dominating STEM. It looks beautiful. It is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to actually fully experience the beauty that it provides for the culture that we are in, you have to understand the language.
Yeah.
And I think that's where my company comes in and say, listen, we teaching you the fundamentals. We teaching you the language. It may not be sexy. It may not look like these other STEM companies, but that language barrier is key, because if you don't understand the language, how can you fully understand the culture?
Right, and you can't communicate.
And you can't communicate because we
all.
Have a whole different language.
We do. Yeah. And everybody has to be able to speak to everyone else regardless of what you're working on. But let me just interject this in. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Beyond the Classroom, and our guest today is Dr. Ja, as he is called, and he's a very accomplished young man, and he and I are geeking out to the nth degree, and we're talking about the importance of understanding STEM and what it actually means and what it takes to be that STEM. STEM is like attached to so many different things. STEM major, for example, which doesn't really exist. You have to pick a concentration or
yes.
a STEM profession, or just being more technologically savvy in our technocentric landscape that we live in now. And it's only going to get more technical with artificial intelligence and cybersecurity, augmented
yes.
reality, and all of those cool looking things that happen when you're playing your video games and whatnot, and watching these 3D movies and this Pixar stuff. All of that requires the rigor of understanding what the S, T, E, and M in STEM actually mean.
Yes.
So we've talked about the M, which is the foundation of everything, and that's the part where we get tripped up. Not just us as Black folks. Everybody gets tripped up for the most
yes.
part on the M, and that's another perception that needs to be addressed in another show. I keep saying that. I'm going to continue to say that, because it appears that Black folks are the ones that can't keep up based on the
yeah.
numbers of people that are employed or receiving STEM discipline, advanced degrees, and even undergraduate degrees. It appears as though we can't keep up, but percentage-wise, 100% of other races are not getting these degrees when they sign up and say, I want to major in chemistry or whatever. That is a myth. But what we want to do is educate the listeners today about STEM and how it is important to be able to dissect it into its parts and understand how these parts work together. So looking at the math and the science, picking a scientific discipline, which is either physics, biology, or chemistry, or some applied or hybrid form of those things or even an interdisciplinary form of those things, and understanding that doing that requires you to have that rigorous math background leads you into creating those video games or those Black Panther movies or something that you need or even that smartphone in your hand. That didn't just happen because somebody said, oh, let's start getting our phone calls and our emails and our photos and all this stuff in this one device. It didn't just magically appear. And that's where the engineering part comes in. And what's going to burst most people's bubble is the fact that the technology, that smartphone is a byproduct. That's just the outcome of doing the S and the M and the E. T solves a problem. T makes something better. Technology isn't the thing that the others flock to. Technology is the thing that comes out of science, math, and engineering. So let me hear your thoughts, Dr. Jha.
I totally agree. And since we're doing education, let's take it back a notch. So everybody thinks, especially us millennials, Silicon Valley is where it's at, where it's like the tech hub. This is where all the geeks, all the nerd people go to, and it's mostly made of technology. And I always challenge them with this question. I said, do you know how I got started, though? Why is it called Silicon Valley? And they was like, no, I don't understand why it's called Silicon Valley. I said, well, let me tell you. Do you know Silicon Valley is founded by chemists and physicists?
Right.
Like,
or what
really?
Silicon is even used for. Why do they know that that's the foundation of the chips in the computers and all of the things that make these smartphones work?
Exactly. And they couldn't use germanium at the time because that was the more popular.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the periodic table above that, it was silicon. And they realized silicon, which is chemical number 14, which is right above germanium, if I'm not mistaken, it's cheaper, and it does the job. And for all my chemists out there, we know anything in the same group of family has similar properties, and it may be more abundant. So that's how it got its name, based off the transistors. And there was a bunch of chemists and physicists came together to produce the technology
right
for the early technology of his day.
Yes.
And they was like,
go ahead.
And I was like, yeah, so that's why there's a lot of tech hubs, quote unquote tech hubs over there, because our foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So we helped y'all create the world that y'all see today.
Oh boy, on so many levels.
So that's why I love having conversations like these, is because I believe, because I'm also a history major as well, so I look at the historical context of the science that I'm studying.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that in order for us to actually understand what we're getting into, we always have to look at a historical concept or context of, okay, how do we get here in order to understand where we're going to move forward towards. And when I looked at the Silicon Valley and understood that, I always smile and say, yeah, it doesn't matter what happens. In order to understand whatever we're doing, we always got to go towards a foundation. And the language of that is mathematics. So to actually really thrive, because I'm not going to lie, there may be some people that can sustain, make some money out of the technology, but to actually be sustainable and actually continue to innovate, you have to understand what is the language, because the language always going to stay the same.
It is, and it's been the same for centuries.
Exactly.
And, and it transcends our traditional sense of language. So math in the United States, math in Germany, math in Italy is the same math.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't change. Those formulas, those proofs, those theorems, they are universal and they are absolute. And so you can't run from it if you move to another country. It's still going to be the same math. And the other thing that I learned, and you may have noticed as well, is that in Europe, for example, their scientists are treated like royalty. They have temples,
yes,
shrines to their scientists. Their scientists used to appear on money before the euro came along.
Yes.
And scholarship is important. It was important. It used to be important. I've blogged about it. I feel very strongly about research and learning and being scholarly for the sake of scholarship, not just saying what I need to learn in order to get past this class or what I need to learn in order to, you know, get this job. And so understanding that the landscape is changing from that manual labor, sit at a desk, there are virtual offices now, so people that have traditionally been able to find work as administrative assistants, for example, those jobs are going to dwindle away eventually. Somebody's going to always need to be there to keep, you know, everything together, but there's technology to help do those things now for people.
Yeah.
And, you know, just across the board, technology is impacting the workforce in some way or another. So you can't just pretend like it's not there and stick your fingers in your ear and say, la, 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 la. It's not going away. But give me a second or two, Dr. Ja, to toot your horn a little bit more, because I left out a whole lot of stuff about you that I intended to mention. I'm going to start with tenor saxophone.
Yes.
Oh, boy. When did you learn to play the tenor sax? What age were you, like 3? Or you got tired of reading math books? Talk to me a minute about that.
Well, the tenor sax, I started playing music when I was young. So I started out the piano around age 5.
Mm-hmm.
And I transitioned over to the tenor saxophone when I was in middle school. I believe I was like 13 or 14.
Mm-hmm.
So I started playing tenor saxophone around those ages. And here's the funny thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I really started mastering math concepts.
That's where I was going with this one.
Yeah.
And
that's why I say STEAM, and I integrate the arts with science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics, because the reason why I got so strong in my math background was because I played instruments, particularly woodwind instruments. And it's particularly the math, for those who are listening, my musicians, the math that I played, the math that I was focused on, I was weak at, but it helped me get strong, were the fractions. Because if you know, every whole note is 4 beats.
One, two, three, four. Yes.
One, two, three, four, and that's the oval shape for my musicians who are listening. the quarter notes is quarter notes for a reason, because it's half of a beat. So 4 quarters and one whole note, 4 quarters and a dollar, so it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 2, 3, 4. So I learned musical composition. I learned fractions through musical composition. And that's how my math got stronger. So when I saw the emergence of STEAM, I personally relate to that, and that's why I said that's what my company, Leap Universal Network, came into the place, because I could see how the artistic view plays into science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And on top of that, all STEAM is to STEM. STEM is more of the black and white TV. STEAM is just the color TV.
That's a great analogy.
That's how I look at it.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I played the violin when I was your age, and so I'm seeing those notes now—the quarter note, the eighth note with the little flag on it, and then the double clef, the bass clef. So all of that is mathematics. You do have to be able to count. You have to be able to stay on beat. So that's the part that tripped me up, because I am a stereotypical nerd as far as coordination and dancing and all that. Just because I'm black doesn't mean I can dance. So yes, but yes, you decided to go to Lincoln University.
Yes.
And then you went to Delaware State. So a young man with your capabilities and talent and opportunities selected to go to two HBCUs to get his credentials. Talk to me about that.
So I would say, first of all, shout out to the first HBCU, Lincoln University of Pennsylvania. It's So I went from the first HBCU to the first state HBCU, which is Delaware State University, because Delaware is the first state according to the United States Constitution. So I always like to say that. It's kind of cool. But going to Link University of Pennsylvania, that was, I'm a legacy of that institution. So my father started a legacy back in 1983.
Okay.
Got his degree in 97. My mom came right after. And she finished her degree around 1989. She finished in 3 years. And my older brother went in 2005. Went in 2001 and graduated 2005. So it was, my household was a bunch were Lincoln graduates. So when it was my time, I already knew where I wanted to go.
Okay.
And I knew I was going to go bleed orange and blue in Lincoln University. So I went there in 2008 after finishing high school. Mm-hmm. And I did well, and that's where I met one of my math professors. This is how I really started strengthening my math, because I really went there to be a mathematics major due to my inspiration of an African-American by the name of Dr. Jesse Ernest Wilkins Jr., who got his PhD at 19. It's not at an HBCU. He went to the University of Chicago, but that's who I looked up to when I was pursuing my journey. So I went to Lincoln University, and I majored in chemistry and also in history. And I finished with 2 degrees after 3 years of matriculating through, because I didn't stop midway. I mean, I didn't stop just fall and spring semester. I just consistently just went to school when it was fall, spring, summer, fall, spring, mm-hmm. summer, then fall and the spring, and I finished. Now, transitioning to Delaware State is an interesting story. My advisor, who Dr. Andrew Gowdy, he was here, and he had research that was very interesting. I was always fascinated with dealing with energy, how energy is being produced, how it's being consumed, and things of that nature. So I was always excited with energy. And my mentor, he introduced me to Dr. Andrew Gowdy, and that's when I came visit the campus. It was funny. It was a snowy day. It was December 16th, 2010, I visited Dr. Andrew Gowdy in his office, and he showed me the labs that he was working in. He showed me the team that I was working with, that I would be working with much later. And to be honest, I was going there to just pursue a master's degree. Mm-hmm. Like, my whole focus was I just want to get a master's to be done, and because my mom and dad had a master's. But he encouraged me to get my PhD. And he did so. He said, well, you only 17, this before I graduated from Lincoln. He said, you're only 17, you might as well go and get your PhD. And he said, I know you're going to move fast based off of your track record. So for those listening, what I mean by track record, I graduated high school at 15, so I did high school in 2 years. So I just finished high school 2 years early. And then when I transitioned on to Lincoln University, I was on track to graduate at 18. So he said, so based off your track record, I know you're going to be finished in a small amount of time. And I was thinking to myself, I said, I don't know, because this is a PhD. So I was nervous. I was like, it's a PhD. Based off the stories I'm hearing, I don't think you're going to finish at a record time. No PhD.
Yeah.
You can tell me 6 years, 7 years. So,
exactly. That's normally how long it does take. Yes.
So with that being said, I was like, I'm going to just apply and see what happens. So I applied. So he encouraged me to apply for the PhD program. I applied in Valentine's Day of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
I got accepted into the program. I got word I was being accepted into the program. And then later, March 11th, and then during that time, I also applied to go to Howard, to Howard's internship program.
Mm-hmm.
Because my mentor introduced me, said, hey, just get some more research experience, check out this program dealing with atmosphere, chemistry. Try to get your feet wet or just get some more experience. So I said, okay. And I said, wow, Howard. I always wanted to go visit Howard. So I applied. I was, and it was at NASA. I mean, it was part of NASA. So I was like, I want to experience that. So I applied, and I was praying for that. Because I was like, I just got this, and I just got accepted into grad school, but I don't want to just waste my summer away until grad school starts. Let me do this. So once I graduated, May 1st, 2011, I was blessed that I got notification. I got accepted into working at Howard University May 5th, 2011.
Wow.
That same week. So I was yes.
Mm-hmm.
So after doing that internship experience, which was awesome, I was able to visit their campus in Bellsville, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, visit Goddard Space Flight Center for all the NASA listeners out there. So, yes, I was at Goddard. And we did a presentation, then I transitioned my way down to Delaware State, which I finished my doctoral work. I did a lot of stuff in my doctorate, from peer review articles to able to start my first patent, and even travel the world to speak at Gordon Research Conference, which I met Dr. Dobbins, Dr. Tabitha, and as well as went to United Kingdom, which I'll be going back again this year, and at Oxford, and then
you're stealing all my thunder from telling everybody this, right?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead. I'm just messing with you. But I did want to say to our listeners, if you are just joining us, Dr. Jha is an amazing young man, and we are talking about Dr. Jha's journey through his academic career, which is a very young one but very full, and that's an understatement. And we are Beyond the Classroom. I'm Dr. Trina Coleman, and Dr. Jha is just an amazing young man. He's interested in education. He loves to learn. He has an awesome legacy. He's had experiences that, you know, seem like, you know, when, just listening to him and his journey, it was like, oh, yeah, by the way, and then yesterday, and then tomorrow, and, like, you know, it was just like almost as if your path was laid out for you so clearly. And I know that that's not how it works.
Yeah.
But you make it, I know it doesn't work like that. It's just amazing that it appears that that's how it was for you, because you were able to do so much in such a short life, and you're still, I mean, it's not like you're done by any means. And you've done some phenomenal things that has taken people a career to get done. I mean, it's a real long career. And it's also coincidental and not so much in a way, because the STEM community, especially amongst our people and especially amongst HBCUs, when you start looking at the pool more in a more granular sense, then you start to see the overlap. And so when you're young, 25, are you 25 now?
I've recently just turned 26.
You're 26. In your 26 years versus my more than 26 years, we do have a couple of points of overlap in our STEM journeys, because you mentioned Dr. Tabitha Dobbins. She's a colleague of mine. There's only a little over 100 female African Americans with PhDs in physics. I'm one, she's one. So I'm one of her, we are colleagues.
Wow.
We have history. And also, my postdoctoral fellowship was done at Howard University's Beltsville Center. And
wow.
So you and I are not too dissimilar as far as the opportunities in STEM and what it takes and how you get on that path and you do it the right way. But doing it the right way also means you have to be academically prepared, because these opportunities don't just come to you. People aren't out there waiting to call you to say, oh, by the way, blah, blah, blah. Well, they're waiting to call you, for example, because they know you put the work in. And there are others of us that have put the work in. But in general, it doesn't work like that. You have to be focused. You have to be driven. And you have to be very exceptional for researchers to want to ask you to work with them. Because normally
exactly.
It's the other way around. And I feel honored to also, I just found that out a few years ago about my PhD advisor. I was like, why me? He was like, oh. I was like, how? He said, well, I picked you. And I picked you because I knew that you had what it took. And at that time, I didn't realize that, you know, there was only one African-American theorist, nuclear theorist at the time in the history of this country. I didn't know that when he picked me, and that was Dr. Shirley Jackson. And
wow.
He was the first female African-American nuclear theorist in this country. She got her PhD in 1973. I was a very young child then. You were not even born. Your parents and I are probably around the same age. But not knowing that that was the path then made knowing that much more special, that more unicorn-like feeling. And what I'm going towards is, how do we find those unicorns that we have in our community and help them to flourish? Where are they? Because you came from a legacy household. Most people do not come from a legacy household. Most of us are first gens. I'm a first gen.
Well, I would say this. They're based off me being an educator. They're everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
For those. And this is how I can say everywhere if you're willing to develop them, because I was mentored, and I was thankful to have a mentor. Out of my household, I'm the only scientist in my household. I come from a family where they're two librarians.
Mm-hmm.
So when it came to walk out my and the first one in my family to get a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they had grad degrees, I didn't realize, I thought it was similar, but it's totally different from getting a PhD, again, a master's, but even that, a master's in a hard science.
Mm-hmm.
So I can relate to people who are dealing with being a first generation and just not even just undergrad, but even grad work as well. Basically, what I noticed as being an educator, because after I finished my postdoc experience, I went back to my community and started trying to cultivate the next unicorn.
Yeah.
And once, because that's what happened to me. So, in going back, I believe it's all about mentorship, and mentorship is key on both parts.
Absolutely.
The mentor has to be willing to be humble and listen to the experiences that the first generation is dealing with, but the accountability of the first generation scholar of listening to the mentor must be held. And
yeah.
The first generation scholar must be willing to listen throughout the process.
Yes.
Because at the end of the day, and I'm saying this for my generation.
Mm-hmm.
Not because your generation probably do listen. The majority listen based off of what I'm seeing and I'm noticing through my experience. I'm saying for my generation, at times, due to the access and technology and due to the accessibility of a YouTube or Facebook and Instagram, we're not willing to listen to the generation that comes before us or after us because of all this access.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that's a bad thing. In a sense, because although the generation before us is not really privy to all this technological stuff that's happening, they still have gems that are underlying the main function on how you gonna move throughout this world.
Right, and were it not for those mentors or people recognizing the talent, then some of us would have been left behind. I would have been one of those people. I would have been the smartest manager at McDonald's or somewhere.
Yes.
You know, because
it's true
because I didn't have or didn't know what to do or how to cultivate the things that I needed to cultivate in order to, you know, get down the path. And I, you know, fortunately, location matters. I was fortunate enough to live a mile and a half away from Hampton University's campus because we didn't have money to send me anywhere. I had been born in one of those little country towns in the middle of nowhere. I still be in that little country town in the middle of nowhere.
Yes.
And ironically, coincidentally, I'll say, I am back home. It's not a country town, but, you know, having access to knowledge, having access to NASA Langley, having access to those hidden figures, even though I didn't realize they existed, it's like two different worlds. It's like you have to be able to transcend your world to go into the other to find that talent that, you know, you can cultivate. I remember when I was in high school and I used to tutor at my church, and there was a student, he was a young man in algebra class, and he was like getting D's in algebra and some F's, and he was one of those kids like us, I know you were one too, who didn't have to write out each step. You look at the problem, you write down one thing, then you get to the answer. And he was getting hit for not doing those steps, which was frustrating him. So he's now a young black man with a very exceptional mind who's frustrated because his grades aren't reflecting the fact that he can solve these problems in his head in his own way.
Yeah.
So those are the ones that get lost, that got lost, if they don't have somebody to step in and help them move down the path, help them see that potential in themselves.
Exactly.
And do that. So talk to me a little bit about your Elite Universal Network. Tell me how you use your company to help find those students and help cultivate the greatness inside of them.
So it's funny to stem off. I have a similar story to what you, in terms of founding Elite Universal, in regards to what you just stated, in regards to tutoring. So when I was younger, growing up in North Philadelphia, I was the tutor in my class when it came to dealing with math. So I was a math tutor. I started out doing math tutoring when I was 10 years old back in my neighborhood. And I was helping I remember I was in fifth grade. I was 10 years old, and I was helping somebody who was in eighth grade. And I saw how, you know, some of the subjects I was studying was relating to their math problem, which was finding X and Y and putting a dot on the graph. So from there, my mom and dad knew that I had a gift in that. And they just continued to just try to position me to get in those type of environments where I just strengthen that gift. That's why I said in the beginning, I wanted to be a mathematician, not a chemist. But the whole chemist came into play because I was in high school. But going back to Elite Universal, from that tutoring experience, I started it at 9. At 13, I established my first company called Giant Enterprise. So Giant Enterprise is basically a math tutoring company. And back then, for those who are listening, STEM wasn't called STEM. It was basically engineering and science when I was coming up. So it was called, like, science and engineering. That was the words that I saw. So when I, or probably STEM was out there, but I didn't know about it. So I was a math tutor because I knew once you learn math, you can understand chemistry, physics, and ultimately engineer. So I was focusing on trying to help people with Algebra 1, Algebra 2, and even some geometry. A lot of people got geometry because it was easy to, it was visual. and I knew them as visual. But in terms of algebra, I was tutoring people in algebra. And I took that same concept into college, but when I found out, and this is now, I understand now, business, my name was taken.
Oh, wow.
So I couldn't use my own. I had Jai with, I said, how they had Jai, J-A-H, stars in the middle of the A, the J and the A, and the A and the H, and it had Enterprise, but they actually had the name. So I had to stop operating under that name. So I had to change the name to Jalites, J-E-L-I-T-E-S. And I had that name when I went into college. So it was 2008 all the way up to 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a conversation with my dad, and my dad was just telling me, listen, this is good. I see you doing the concept, but ultimately – soon you're going to have to probably take your name off. Because let's say you get big and somebody owns your company. It's not going to make sense. They own your name. They probably change it to something that's going to reach everybody. And I was wrestling with it. And I remember I was walking home from after class. And this is grad school now. I'm in grad school. So I walk home from class and the name just came to me. It was Elite Universal. And I spelled it E-L-I-T-E, Universal. But then after reading a book by T.D. Jakes, he was saying the main question everybody want to know is why, in terms of finding a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that's it. So I changed the E-L-I, and I changed the I to a Y.
Uh-huh.
Because I believe when you find your why, your purpose, you'll operate on an elite level.
Wow.
So that's why it's E-L-Y-T-E, not E-L-I-T-E. Because if you say E-L-I-T-E, the I signifying I am better. But if you find your why, you can establish excellence on how we can be better.
Wow.
So that's how Elite Universal came in and established as a tutoring company.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped doing tutoring as of 2016 because I saw that tutoring is tweaking their system. And this, I want to build a new system because now I'm a PhD now. 2016, I'm Dr. Hayes now. And I saw the problems with the school system. And I'm saying I can't even tweak it anymore because now I'm the teacher.
Right.
I got to change it. Matter of fact, not even change, I got to replace it. And I had to do that for my classroom. So Elite Universal ultimately became what it is now. It's a programming company, or it's a STEAM content company, where I come in and I change curriculums.
Mm-hmm.
I put a whole new curriculum in based off of audio, visual, and tactile learning that's happening in your classroom from K to 12. And I started off with study guides at first because a lot of my students at the time had individual – I had to do individualized instructions for every one of my students because a lot of my students had an individual education plan. My educators know what I'm talking about, also known as IEPs.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't teach them in a traditional sense. I couldn't, as Professor C, lecture to them. I had to suit their specific needs based off of how they learn. So I had to create individual lesson plans for 25 kids.
Wow.
So I said, shoot, if I'm doing this and I had to do it for a class, and this is just one class, and I taught in South Philadelphia, and it was from a school in South Philadelphia, and I saw this problem. I said, okay, I know this, and this is in the urban community, but the project is across the street. So I'm saying, okay, if that's the case, what happens in the whole 50 states if this is happening in my city? So that's why I established, I said, okay, we're starting out with study guides. So I had to, that's why I called them study guides, but there's actual lessons for the kids, for the scholars. And then ultimately, I start doing many workshops, and I did my first summer program that same year, 2016, and said, you know what, since I'm designing programs, let's just do curriculums, where I touch students visually, auditorily, and then hands-on instructions in science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. Now, the arts is just the creative way in which I do that. But that's how the whole that's how the whole concept of Leap Universal came into play, and that's how we are operating now.
Okay.
So we more we not as like I told people, we're not more the fun side where we doing this, that, and the third.
Right.
We doing robotics. I focus on the systemic because if you focus on the system, you could change the culture. When you change the culture, you'll be able to advance African Americans in different ways.
Right. And the other thing I want to add to that is the fact that the people, and I'm not going to point out any particular group, but when these workshops and summer camps and things come up for STEM, and, you know, it's 1 week, 2 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, I think that it's relevant only in the fact that it's giving the kids somewhere to go, and whoever the corporate sponsor is gets a photo op with these people. But I'm with the check. They do. They come in, take some pictures, say we did our part.
Yep.
And so the kids go home with a, you know, some swag or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But did they pick up anything?
No takeaway.
They could use and continue beyond the classroom, which goes back to why we are having this conversation. and I feel very passionately about these things because it's our responsibility, people like you and me, to make sure that we go into our communities and we also partner with our HBCUs and our colleagues at our HBCUs so that we take ownership of our own without relying on $10. I mean, because the other thing is these STEM programs, and I want to say this for the listeners who have children that are K through 12 or are in that K through 12 themselves or about to graduate from high school and think they're going to be a physician and they don't have the rudimentary skills to pass general physics, because they have to pass general physics in order to be a pre-med major.
Mm-hmm.
It's not realistic if you aren't ready. And it's our responsibility to make sure that if they're not ready before they get there, that they get ready while they're there.
Yes.
And, you know, it's also about realizing that a lot of them don't have that guidance at home. A lot of us, I won't say them, a lot of us don't or didn't have that guidance at home. And I tell people all the time, I'm the only doctor I'm related to. I am. I'm the only one I'm related to. And so being able to navigate those waters, I'm not a physician, but still, whatever, I have the credential. But being able to navigate those waters without having mentors or a support system that understands what it takes to get you there is not going to happen. It will not happen. You will not get there. Some will, but most won't, especially if they are in a hostile environment, which is one of the other things that students of color, you know, encounter when they go to PWIs. So they already are in a discipline that's difficult. But then to have that other, you know, distraction and, you know, socioeconomic barriers and just all of those things in the way make it that much more difficult. What did you want to say about that?
Well, I would interject, and I think it comes down to, again, just being I think, honestly, this is going to be like a whole different conversation, but it's in the sense of black economics. So if you think about black economics, it doesn't start with just the money. It starts with the mindset, right?
Yeah.
So unless you even change it to, okay, STEM economics or understand the STEM conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
When our underserved communities look at STEM, science, mathematics, engineering, the first thing that comes in their mind is their mind shut down and say, oh, I don't want to do it.
Right.
So I've noticed that basically from teaching. And
that's
step one. and actually breaking that conditioning factor. And the way we break that conditioning factor is, and this is where, again, you have to entertain to educate. What I mean by entertain. Show them the fun stuff. Show them what you can get and then work backwards.
Yes.
From it. And, like, what I do, and this is why I'm glad I'm young as I am, I can show them what getting a PhD gets you outside the classroom.
Beyond the classroom.
Beyond the classroom. And what it can provide for you other than just saying, oh, I work in the lab, just saying a third. It's a lifestyle. What's the lifestyle you get when you get a doctor?
Right.
And then after showing that lifestyle, because I'm noticing this from my generation, then the generation under, okay, now I showed you what you can get from it. Now let's show you, okay, what is the concept of what it's going to take to get to that lifestyle? Because I think what a lot of individuals do, they show you the lifestyle, but they don't want to tell you the steps. And what I think we have to do, and our responsibility as STEM influencers, is that come back and say, these are the steps to the lifestyle that you want. Because,
right.
And the reason why I say that is because I noticed this with just dealing with my age group. They look at me and say, oh, you doctor so-and-so, you must got a lot of money. First of all, yes, I do, but I may or may not have a lot of money, but that's not, the lifestyle may look like I do, but in a sense, you have to understand what I had to do to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to get there, let me show you how to get there. So you, if that's what you want to do, make a lot of money, that's you. That shouldn't be the goal. But if that's what you see, at least understand that it takes hard work, effort, and diligence to get to where it's at. Because I'm not going to lie, according to Hollywood, it's a pro and a con.
Mm-hmm.
STEM does look cool, but it's a lot of work for being cool. It's not like high school where you can just throw on a nice jacket or look beautiful and say, okay, I'm cool.
Right.
It takes a lot. They come into a concept of, now we got to add a business perspective to it or a more entrepreneurial perspective to it. You can always work in industry. You can always work in a lab, but see what it could be done and how to think entrepreneurial and creative, but do it in the midst of STEM.
Yes, and I think that that's one of the things that going to an HBCU has given you the skill set, well, it's ingrained in you, to be able to even think about or approach a group of young men like that with that idea and that concept, because you're always looking out for and trying to figure out a way to improve the community because of the opportunities that have been provided you and the intellectual capacity that you have, which gives you the tools to have the critical thinking and analytical thinking and bring those qualities out of others, because we all come equipped with some level of critical thinking. It may not be developed properly, but even drug dealers can think critically. they don't
it
for the right reasons, but they have a system, and they have a level of intellect that allows them to build that business out and make it successful. Because successful drug dealers know how to do things, organize, manage people, manage product, do inventory, profit and loss, and all of those things that go into building a business. And go ahead.
But in addition to that, that system that you just described, I also explain to my students, African Americans are underserved community. You know how we make it out the ghetto? We use the scientific method to make it out the ghetto.
Yes.
And they said, how we do that? I said, okay, observation. We look around, say, dang, everybody in my hood is broke. That's observation, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's okay. What's the question? Time to make some money. Then make it out the situation, right?
Yes.
It's like, yeah. I said, now we're going to the hypothesis, educated guess. And it ties in with the observation. You see somebody, nice clothes, look good, got a nice car. You ask him what he do. He said, oh, I do this, that, and the third. Hypothesis. If I do this, that, and the third, then I can make it out the ghetto.
Right.
I said, okay, so now let's go to the methodology or the procedures. Okay, what I got to do? You got to do this, got to do this, got to do this, got to do this, got to do this. Those are the steps to reach your hypothesis, right? It's like, yeah. So you do that. You start saying, okay, I do this, I flip this, I get that. I do this, I flip this, I get that. That's your data. And then at the end of the week, you count your money, and that's your what? You make a what? They said a conclusion. I said, so y'all do it, y'all just don't know.
Right. They don't know what to call it. All they know is that they're doing what they're doing, and they're getting money. And not even understanding and being able to dissect the process and write it out and explain it to somebody else.
Exactly.
And so being able to do that in general also, I think, will give our students the wherewithal to decide what they really want to do with themselves, too, because a lot of them don't even know. And we're pushing STEM so hard, and I'll say we as a nation, as opposed to we as me and you, but without being able to describe or explain the benefits or how, as we've already discussed, what it takes to do it, do you even want to do it? And do you have the capability? Everybody isn't wired the same, and I'm going to just say it. Everybody can't do it.
Yeah.
Everybody's not capable of doing calculus. They can try. They may be able to understand some of the concepts, but if it was that easy, we would all be doing it. It wouldn't be a problem.
Exactly.
So being able to find those that can and those that are willing to put the work in and those that we can cultivate at our HBCUs and those that are already there doing wonderful things like you, that's where we need to start moving forward to empower ourselves and stop getting in a situation where we think it's a good thing that Corporation X came and dropped $10,000 on you when they're dropping $1 million in other places. And, you know, and keeping it moving. Because that's really what's going on.
But
and,
also,
go ahead.
But also, that's what ties in into, that also ties in into the whole facts of black economics. I think honestly, and this is why I say I teach my young guys how to make it on their own and become entrepreneurial. When you do that, you can show that you have value instead of somebody trying to provide money, which they think money is equal to value. You could provide value not just in terms of money for yourself, but you provide value that you use your intellect to create some revenue rather than wait on somebody to say, here. I mean, some people you can do that for. I mean, for some some programs and some that you can do that for. But if you know that is that what's going to happen, then we must understand, okay, how we can try to match what they want to do. How can we show a proof of concept where we know it's valuable instead of somebody telling you what's the value of what you're doing?
Right. And that's why I don't have a nonprofit.
Nate, that's why I don't have a nonprofit.
You don't have one either?
No, because I believe that you got to create. If you create value,
mm-hmm.
you know what you're doing.
Cause right.
Because you know what you bring it to the table. Rather than trying to figure out what you bring it to the table.
Or let somebody else judge you saying that you are worthy of their $10 because
exactly.
you can jump through hoop X, Y, and Z. And let me say this before anybody gets offended. I am not bashing nonprofits at all.
No.
I'm just saying that in certain environments, such as STEM, there are a lot of different organizations right now that are doing STEM-related work. They have the word STEM somewhere in their title. Various levels of credentials, experience, et cetera. But, you know, the competition for these dollars is fierce. And
yes.
organizations such as the ones that you and I have don't usually get the lion's share of the money. We got to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that we're the greatest, best, and most, but we still don't look the right way. So writing proposals and crossing your fingers and, you know, waiting to see if you're going to get that money from somebody, and then you get it, and then you still have to go through a whole bunch of paperwork and all that. What did you do? You have to do this with the money by this date, and you can only get this much for yourself, and this, that, and no, I can make my own program. You can make your own program on your own terms because you understand the need. Because those dollars are based on what somebody else's perception of the need is without having ever immersed themselves in the environment or the situation. They're saying from outside, and that's one of the things I think is broken with this whole STEM diversity, gender gap, race thing, is the fact that those that are judging it don't live it, haven't lived it, will never live it. So how are you going to tell me what I need to be doing if you don't know what I'm doing in the first place and you've never done it and you aren't capable of doing it?
Well, I would say this, and that's why it's into our conversation. When it got into the hands of Hollywood, that's when, like, for example, I love Hidden Figures, and it's funny, my mentor told me about the Hidden Figures before they even hit the screen. I know about Katherine Johnson, or Katherine Bogle at the time. I knew about the other two that helped contribute. I knew
Mary
about
Jackson
that before.
And Dorothy Vaughn. Yep.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I knew about them before. I knew about them in 2011 when I touched down at Howard, because that's when my mentor was telling me about it. So, like I said, I'm balanced on the happiness and also looking at it some type of way. I'm happy in the sense that we're finally getting our due, but I'm also on the fence because it's great because it's showing diversity in terms of women rising up to STEM, but it always had. I believe it's always been there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of now, yes, you have the exposure, but now are you ready to provide the education?
Yeah.
And I think that's where people get it misconstrued. They show the exposure and they show the entertainment, but they're not ready to actually roll out the education. So you're showing an incomplete path on what it takes to be an actual STEM professional.
Well, let me say this, and I'm going to pick up on that point. But those listening, I hope you're enjoying our conversation. This is Beyond the Classroom with Dr. Trina Coleman, and I am talking to our guest today, Dr. Jalal Hayes, or Dr. Ja. And we are talking about real STEM, real life, our children, our HBCUs, reality versus perception of STEM, and how we're going to try to make things better and improve upon what we contribute today. Because 100 years ago, even 50, 60 years ago, as Dr. Jha just mentioned about the Hidden Figures, we were making contributions. And the thing that, you know, once again, that's very close to me, Dr. Jha. I mean, I'm right here, sitting here right now in Hampton, Virginia. Grew up here where NASA Langley is. Met Katherine Johnson. I actually was at the private screening when Hidden Figures was first done. It was done here in Hampton, right across the street from my office. So I'm very close to the story. I actually did my 2 summer undergraduate internships at NASA Langley. She hadn't retired yet the first year I was there. I had no idea who she was.
Wow.
I had no idea who she was. And so those are the things that make me feel a type of way, because I lived and grew up here in the city where the first NASA site was built. And I didn't have access at an early age to those people. I don't even know when I found out we even had a NASA. I know that we had some, you know, input as far as Langley was concerned, because the Air Force Base is also called Langley here, and they're both connected. But being in a situation where you can be exposed to things, but you're not exposed to things, is something that we also need to try to do better with our kids. Better with at our HBCUs. Just like you stated when you were at Howard doing your summer internship while I was there doing other stuff. But I was on the admin side by 2011 running the IT stuff. But being able to take advantage of the environment, of the access, you had access to great scientists, you had access to great equipment, you know, and all of those things, and being able to expound upon that and take some of that stuff back and not in that format of, oh, by the way, here, check this thing out. It's a rain gauge or something like that. Pour some water in this thing and you'll watch gauge raise up and it'll tell you how much rain is out there or something. You know, those things are cool to look at, but what's the takeaway? You have to have a clear and concise takeaway be able to nurture that curiosity in a child, and even starting in K and moving all the way up to 12, because if it's not there by a certain age, as you know, it's not coming.
Yeah.
And being able to make that happen, and also being able to keep our students or recruit our students to HBCUs is a whole nother show, because right now, you having your, you know, you got it golden right now, and that's a wonderful thing. You know, you're doing things. You have you've authored books. You've given TED Talk. You are about to be a keynote speaker at a conference at the University of Oxford. You are doing the things that you love to do, while at the same time in parallel trying to reach out and help pull along some others. That's what our obligation is.
Exactly.
And it's a monumental task. But we were given that obligation, and it happened over 150 years ago. And it was done willingly then. When our HBCUs were founded, they were founded on STEM. They were founded on STEM. Agricultural and technical, A&T. A&M's, all of that stuff is STEM-based. And so working together and making sure that everybody was able to share what they had, if somebody needed something, pulling them along, making sure that they were safe in Jim Crow times, all of that stuff that we've kind of just pushed to the side or become very lax about because we have this civil rights mentality now when, you know, it's our mentality has changed over generations because we've gotten farther and farther away from the struggle that it took to get us to where we are now.
Yeah.
And we still have a long struggle to go, but going back to our HBCUs and making sure that we appreciate them and the Katherine Johnsons they produce and the Dr. Jobs, you know, make sure they're safe and covered and have what they need to sustain.
Exactly.
We need to keep doing that. And I see you doing that, and I appreciate you for it. And Dr. Jha, when are you coming back? And before you, we close and wrap it up here, how do people reach you, Dr. Jha? What do you tell people how to get in touch with you and find out more about your programs?
Well, you can reach me on my Instagram. You can follow me at drjahayes, Dr. Jha Hayes. You can reach me there. Or you can send me an email at info@elyteunetwork.com. Again, that's info@elyteunetwork.com. You can reach me at those two places. Also, if you're on LinkedIn, you can reach me at Jalal Hayes, PhD.
Wow. Dr. Jha, you know, I would love to talk to you just all day long, and I'm sure we will have other conversations, and I will have you back on the show, but thank you for being on the inaugural edition of Beyond the Classroom. I can't thank you enough. This has been such an engaging conversation. I hope our listeners take away a lot. I hope they're thinking about a lot. And those that are HBCU alums or students or affiliated in any way, think about what it is we need to do to help bolster up our kids, our students, our workforce, so that they are competitive in this new technocentric landscape that we are now living in. And I do want to talk to you about intellectual property as well, Dr. Jha. So we're going to have that conversation next time, especially as it relates to HBCUs, because we don't do that real well.
That's my area.
I know it is. I know it is. And thank you so much. And thank you, everyone. You are listening to Beyond the Classroom with Dr. Trina Coleman. And until next time, thank you.